There is a place in the scripture that says, rejoice with those who rejoice. And if you have not read the morning paper, you must read it carefully when you go home and rejoice with one of the members of this church, Mr. Jeff Burke, who has done with some oil wells what everybody hopes to do. We are delighted, those of us who know Jeff well, to see him have such great good fortune. I understand that sermon titles are not famous for making people's pulses pound wildly when they sit down in the pew and take a look at the bulletin. But the one this morning quite possibly hits an all-time low for pure, unadulterated dullness. It wasn't something I tried to achieve. It's just that when you've promised to talk about the fiction of inerrancy, it's pretty hard to know how to disguise that pedestrian topic with a titillating title. Most of you live happy, productive lives without ever hearing the word inerrancy, or caring much, I should think, about what it means. But in many churches, it is, without question, the most important word in the doctrinal vocabulary. And since you have friends in those churches, and your children will be influenced by those to whom this word is important, I think we have to talk about it just this once. It doesn't take much of a student to break the compound word inerrancy down. Something not errant, that is, not given to mistake. Used among fundamentalist Christians, it describes the Bible as infallible. It is an item of faith that there cannot be an error of any kind in that marvelous book. If, in the course of doing what the Bible is interested in doing, telling us how to live better, it happens to touch on history, then it must be accepted as absolutely reliable, no matter how much evidence there may be that on some point it is not. Whatever it touches on, and however incidentally, on geography, astronomy, botany, geology, mathematics, it must be accepted as infallible. If it says something contradictory to science, then science is wrong and not the Bible. I mentioned botany just now, which reminds me that in Matthew 13, Jesus tells a little parable in which he says flatly that the mustard seed is the smallest of all seeds. Well, this happens not to be true. Botanists know of smaller seeds than the mustard seed. Jesus didn't. So he elected to use the popular view and made a remark which, in purely scientific terms, is wrong. It doesn't affect his main argument. It's a peripheral matter, but the fact is that his comment is not true in the strictest sense. The sacred text proves itself to be fallible. This whole business about infallibility, either his or the Bible's, would have amazed Jesus anyway. When the disciples asked him a certain question once, he said cheerfully enough, "I don't know. I don't know." He professed surprise on several occasions, which is also a clear indication of not knowing everything. You are surprised by what you don't know. We're told on at least two occasions that he grew in knowledge, that he learned things. Obviously, one who grows and learns is not already perfect. And when somebody tried to make him perfect, he responded, "Why do you call me good? There is one good, one perfection, and that is God." So he would be astonished, I think, at the kind of idolatry which has been built up through the centuries toward the Bible. Our Southern Baptist friends, millions of them, have been caught up for several years now in a huge and painful controversy over this word inerrancy. Some great old Baptist seminaries have been torn apart by the insistence that no professor be allowed to teach there unless he or she subscribes to the theory of inerrancy, of infallibility for the Bible in all its utterances on any topic. This is a terrible dilemma for a bright and studious minister or a seminary professor, because it doesn't really take a genius to discover that there are contradictions in numbers, in sequences of events, in different versions of the same stories, that there are grammatical errors and faulty etymologies at work, and statements of fact which simply cannot be supported. So some seminaries are in a dither, and some professors have been purged. And if you want to know just how contemporary this dull topic is, my latest copy of The Christian Century, delivered only yesterday, has a note about Southeastern Baptist Theological Seminary in Wake Forest, North Carolina, where the trustees have changed the whole faculty selection process to guarantee that no professor will be hired who does not believe in biblical inerrancy. No one is quite sure just how this huge denomination will resolve that problem, but there's a great deal of turmoil and heartache being caused by our humdrum little word, inerrancy. But if it's their problem and not ours, why should I talk about it? My answer is that I feel obliged to help parents know how to talk intelligently to their children when the children visit another church, hear ideas very different from ours, and come home wondering what to make of it, especially when children from another church say something like this, "Oh, I see, your church doesn't believe the Bible," or some such piece of nonsense, which, nonsense or not, requires answering for a child's peace of mind. A strong, sustaining faith is something more than just feeling good on Sundays. It involves some clear, tough knowledge of how one faith differs from another and why we hold the faith we hold. So even if the fiction of inerrancy hasn't set your pulses pounding this morning, please be kind and curious for a few minutes, and let's enjoy learning a couple of things together. It's strange in a way that this word inerrant should be so vital to fundamentalist faith, because it is not a biblical word, and infallibility is something the Bible never claims for itself. It is an idea made up out of our longing for the comfort of something perfect in an imperfect world. Life has enough problems, what with job worries and staying healthy and preserving the family. So if someone can set an infallible Bible or an infallible interpretation before us so that at least we don't have to worry about that part of life, we jump at it gladly. Even so, it's a relatively modern idea. For hundreds of years, Catholic theologians knew perfectly well that they had a fallible book on their hands, and it was their feeling that it should therefore be interpreted by those trained to handle such a complex library of books and not hand it over to the masses who they thought, with some justification, would make a mess of it. At the top of their hierarchy of authority was a single figure, the Holy Father, who, when he spoke ex cathedra from the chair, officially was held to be infallible, inerrant. When Protestants broke away from Rome, they lost that particular source of certainty, but they quickly found another. Deprived of an infallible pope, they created for themselves an infallible book to take his place. And as time passed, they became as dogmatic about the Holy Book as their ancestors had been about the Holy Father. Or perhaps more dogmatic, because while the pope was infallible only at designated times, the Bible became infallible at all times and on all topics. And what happened next was as predictable as the phases of the moon. As Protestants had once joyously bashed the idea of an infallible pope, so now skeptics began joyously to bash the idea of an infallible Bible. Articles and books pointed out all the mistakes and contradictions in the Bible, and lecturers on public platforms dared God to strike them dead that minute for saying that the Bible was full of mistakes. It was all a rather silly business, but religion has attracted silliness through the centuries like a mountain peak luring lightning. It is so easy to prove that inerrancy is a fiction that it's almost embarrassing to feel one still has to talk about it. But children keep growing up who have to learn it all over again. I've been astonished through the years by how carelessly we read. Even when somebody gives us an advance warning that if we read with care, we will discover some very fascinating things. For example, when my university students were assigned to read about the plagues in Egypt, I would always say, please read slowly and carefully and come to class prepared to tell me what violations of logic you discover in the text. But only now and then would somebody read so thoughtfully as to come back with the right answers. One violation of logic has to do with how it is possible to kill all the herds of Egypt in one of the plagues, only to have more herds of Egypt available for killing in the next one. No single author was silly enough to make that kind of glaring mistake. The plagues are a composite account written by at least two and perhaps more than two authors so that they ramble up and down, duplicate each other, and betray all sorts of internal inconsistencies. You don't have to study more than just those five chapters in Exodus to know for yourself the fiction of inerrancy. But you say if it's relatively easy to see those mistakes and contradictions, why wouldn't everybody see them, including the fundamentalists themselves who believe in the idea of inerrancy? And the answer to that is that most of them do not go home on Sunday afternoons any more than you do to sit down with a Bible, pencil and paper to make charts and comparative readings. They believe their preacher, as most of you right now are believing yours, so that in both cases, you can consider the matter settled and get on to important things like tonight's basketball game. But there are also some believers in the infallibility of the Bible who know perfectly well that it has mistakes in it, but who have developed a counter strategy to save their doctrine of a perfect book. Now listen carefully for a moment. Okay, they admit, the present biblical text may have some mistakes and contradictions, but the original text was perfect. When God first gave the world, they say, books like Joshua and Judges and Ruth and Revelation, they did not have a single error of any kind in them. So it is still proper to speak of the Bible as inerrant. Well, this is a very surprising kind of logic. In the first place, it brings all discussion to a halt because it is an argument that is beyond proof. We do not have an original copy anywhere on earth of so much as a single biblical book. So we have no idea what those original copies may have been like. Many of us would suppose that they had their own share of minor mistakes, since human beings were involved with them. But for the sake of a second argument, let's pretend for a moment that they were perfect and that it is only the present collection of scriptures that show contradictions and discrepancies. This would suggest that while God had the will and the power to create a perfect first copy of Genesis or John, he lacked either the will or the power to keep them perfect. But since the first copy would have been seen only by a relative handful of readers, while the later copies would be read diligently by hundreds of millions of readers, logic would suggest that infallible later copies would be far more important than infallible first ones, which were going to be lost anyway. The Bible is a marvelous, amazing book to which the ripest scholars in the world, Jews, Catholics, Protestants, have devoted their lives. But it is not a mechanically infallible book, and we do it wrong to try to make it into something it is not. The Bible grew out of certain historical contexts. It has the marks of those contexts clearly upon its pages. It has to be studied with the help of every historical and linguistic scholarship one can make use of. But its positive values are so many that we base our civilization and our church upon it, and it is not diminished when we admit that the normal problems of a written text are present in our scripture. I want you to know more about it rather than less, but I also want you to know the truth, because that's where freedom is found, and we are lovers of freedom in this church. Informed, responsible freedom, which requires, I'm afraid, now and then, a sermon like this one. Thank you for listening well. And if you are a guest in this house today, let's get acquainted. Have a cup of coffee downstairs and look like a stranger with so much pleasant persistence that we will forsake one another and find you and say hello. And come back, please, next week when I solemnly promise you not to talk about the fiction of inerrancy, part 2.